So thank you so much for having me here today. It's absolutely wonderful. I'm from Chicago. It was snowing a week before I got here. And I just gotta say, it's just been fantastic, both environmentally both in the weather and in the physics that's been there. So it's just really fantastic. Okay, so today I'm gonna tell you a little bit about small galaxies and the big science that comes from them. So, as Lars mentioned, I'm here for a cold dark matter workshop. I'm going to be talking about galaxies, but really the emphasis in trying to understand these smallest and faintest and dimmest galaxies is to understand what makes up most of them, which is dark matter. So most of these galaxies, by mass, are actually made of dark matter. And dark matter is the stuff that we really want to understand. So I'm going to kick off this talk basically going from the small to the large, to give you an overview of sort of what our status in the understanding of dark matter is. Then I'm going to turn things around and I'm going to say, okay, if we believe that there is dark matter in the universe and we run simulations forward in time, we can make a prediction for the types of galaxies that we would see. And I'm going to tell you then a little bit about some of the work that we've been doing over the past few years to try and test those predictions on the scale of the very smallest galaxies. Then, if there's time, I know that I completely encourage questions. Questions are great. If we end there, that's fantastic. If at that point there's still more time, I'll tell you a little bit about what happens to these galaxies when they actually fall into our Milky Way. Does that sound like a good plan?
Yeah.
All right, good. Okay, so to kick things off, I'm going to tell you a little bit about rotation curves. Okay, so rotation curves are essentially a way that we understand how the velocity of objects changes with their the distance from the center of the object. So I think everyone in the audience has seen one of these as a record player. Even I have seen a record player. Okay, so so if you look at points along the record, right? All of these points move together. This is a solid rotator, right? So it's a fixed body. So if you move the record from this position to that position, all the points move together. This means that in order for that to happen, the points on the outermost part of the record have to move faster than the points on the innermost part of the record. So if you were to take this diagram and plot it as a function of the radius, so the distance between the center of the record and each point, and the velocity of those points, you would see a linear relationship here, where the velocity of points goes up as you go farther away from the center of the record. Okay, so now this is another system that we're pretty familiar with. This is the orbits of the inner planets. And you can see here that the planets are not moving all together. They're not a rigid rotator. What you'll have to sort of trust me on, but I think if you look at this carefully, is that not only does this planet on the outside here, this is Mars, have a longer distance to go around the Sun, but it's actually moving slower as it goes on that path. And that's related to the fact that gravity is a long-range force, and that the strength of the gravitational attraction falls off as you go out farther in radius. So if you now similarly plot as a function of the radius, so the distance from the Sun, the orbital velocity of the planets, you see that they fall off as you go to larger and larger radii. And the shape of this curve is actually, it goes as 1 over the square root of the radius. And this is what's predicted from standard Newtonian gravitational dynamics. This is an observation that was already made hundreds of years ago. So if we now go out and look at galaxies, galaxies are just collections of stars. We expect those stars to be to obey the same fundamental gravitational laws as the planets do around the Sun. And so we can ask the question of how fast do we see stars in galaxies going around the central mass of these galaxies? So we can go out and make this measurement, and what we would expect if we use just the Keplerian laws, the Newtonian dynamics that we are familiar with, is that first, the stars would be going faster as a function of radius, and this is because The gravitational force that those stars feel comes from the total enclosed mass. So as you go farther out from the galaxy, you're enclosing more mass. So stars will actually move faster. And then once you get outside, essentially all the mass of the galaxy, you would drop off as a 1 over r squared, square root of r log. Right? What we actually measure is that this rise continues out to much larger radii. And for a large range of galaxies, the velocity of clouds of gas, generally, which is what we measure out here, is independent of the radius from the galaxy. And so this has been generally interpreted in two conventional frameworks. One is that we don't understand laws of gravity. And the other is that perhaps there is some missing gravitational mass that is causing these objects far from the centers of galaxies to feel a stronger gravitational force than what we would naively expect from the matter that we can see. So we can move on to even larger structures in the universe. So galaxies cluster into clusters of galaxies. These objects have a huge amount of mass, hundreds to thousands of times the mass of our Milky Way galaxy. And they can actually take the light from a background galaxy as it passes close to this object, feels this gravitational force, and can actually be bent and focused. Okay? And so by measuring the curvature of this light path, you can estimate how much mass must belong to this object. From measuring the integrated light, all the light that's given off by the stars and the galaxies in this cluster, you can estimate how much visible mass you have, and you find that these disagree again. And so this is just a cartoon, but you can see this in real imaging data. So this is the central galaxy of a massive cluster. And what you see are these arcs around the cluster that are coming from the light of background galaxies actually being bent as it passes close to this very massive object. And you can see sort of by eye that some of these arcs are actually bluer in color than a lot of the galaxies in the cluster of galaxies, which tend to be yellower. And this is because these galaxies are actually in the background at a period in the universe where star formation was happening much more rapidly. These are young, bright, blue star-forming galaxies. You can actually go and measure the spectrum of light from these galaxies, and you can tell that in addition to distorting the images of galaxies, sometimes you can get multiple images. Because on the previous slide, if I go back, you can see that there are multiple paths that the light can take around this cluster of galaxies to get to us.
So, Alex, in this image, can you give us a sense of the size, the mass of these galaxies relative to the Milky Way?
This cluster of galaxies is at a redshift of about 0.7, which means a redshift of 1 is essentially when the universe was half the age that it is today. These central galaxies can be a factor of 10 to 100, the Milky Way. The cluster of galaxies is very massive, 10 to the 14 solar masses. The Milky Way is dimensionally 10 to the 12. These background galaxies, so I don't know the actual stellar mass of these, but they're very likely more similar to the Large Magellanic Cloud, Milky Way mass, or maybe slightly smaller than that.
Jeez.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, other questions about this?
Yeah, just a quick question.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look at these pictures, I see sort of elliptical lenses. I mean, am I right? So is there any reason why it's asymmetric?
So you're saying that that the distribution of... Okay, so the answer is that the clusters themselves are not spherical.
Right.
And this is actually a prediction of the dark matter model. So if you take dark matter and you look at how it clusters, the clustering distributions that you get are actually triaxial, meaning that they're like squashed beach balls.
Okay. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Question.
you talked about the blue color of the galaxy in the rear of the screen image.
Yeah.
And that's coming from a time when the galaxies were producing stars early on in the universe, or more earlier than the
Yeah.
Universe.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'll talk about this a little more. But the basic idea here is that that the bluest stars are also the biggest, the hottest, and the fastest burning. And so if you're forming stars, the blue ones are the ones that are going to die off first. And so in order to have a blue object, it means that it needs to be actively replenishing those brightest stars. Needs to be actively forming stars. And so this is something that a way that we use the colors of objects to actually understand something about what's going on in their star formation history.
But it's farther away.
Yeah.
It should be redshifted more. So how does it end up blue?
So it is.
Ultraviolet when it's for sitting astronauts.
Yeah, so it is redshifted, but it is also intrinsically blue. So yeah, this is yeah.
Are these color adjusted?
Ooh, this is a good question. So this is HST imaging. So the answer is yes. Hubble. This is Hubble Space Telescope imaging. So these are adjusted. They're not the native colors. But the way to think about this is as the relative color. So I'll talk about this a little bit more. But what you do is you have an imaging device, and you put a filter in front of it and collect light that gets through that optical filter. So you have a filter that lets longer wavelengths of light through. Then you take an image of the same part of the sky with a filter that lets shorter wavelengths through. And the relative difference in the amount of light that you collect from objects with the two filters in front gives you what is technically called a color. It has a more technical meaning than just, oh, I look at this and it looks blue. It means really that there are more, there is more emission in the shorter wavelengths of light than the longer wavelengths of light. Okay, so up until now, I've been showing you objects where we see this anomalous gravitational influence that's connected or centered around the distribution of light that we actually see. And so I haven't proved to you that we just don't understand gravity, right? The most popular model that's put forth says that it's actually the visible mass that is causing the gravitational attraction, but it's just felt differently at long ranges. This image, however, is very hard to explain with a model like that. So I'm going to walk you through this image in a little bit more detail. So this is actually two clusters of galaxies. One is located here, one is located here. And they've actually collided with each other. So the galaxies are like grains of sand in a room, right? They pass through, you're taking two rooms with some grains of sand in them and passing them through each other. The galaxies don't care. They don't hit each other. It's very sparse, right? But the air in the room gets tangled up, right? If you were to slam two rooms together, you get this huge shock wave in the air. And that's what you're seeing in pink here, which is the X-ray emission from intergalactic gas in these clusters of galaxies. And that gas actually has more mass than all of the galaxies in the clusters of galaxies by a factor of roughly 6. Okay? And so all of the mass of these clusters of galaxies is in the pink regions here. But if you go and take that gravitational lensing that I was showing you before, and you try and map out where the strongest lensing is happening, it's actually happening in these blue regions that are centered around the galaxies, which have relatively little mass. And so what this object, this is called the bullet cluster, what it has shown is that you can actually, you separate most of the visible mass from most of the gravitating mass. And that's very hard to explain with any model that modifies the gravitational force that's connected to the stuff that we see. Okay, so now I'm gonna make one last point about the existence of dark matter and how we know so much. And this is a little technical, but it's actually one of our strongest pieces of evidence. So I'm going to try and walk you through it. And I think you'll get it and probably ask me questions that are too hard for me to answer. But okay, so what I'm going to show here, this is a movie. This is from NASA, associated with their WMAP satellite. And the idea here is that you have two ponds, and we're going to drop rocks into these ponds. Okay. And so the two ponds have very different, basically, damping coefficients, right? And so you can see the rock, I'll run this quickly again. The rock on the left-hand side, the waves were damped out much more quickly, whereas the rock on the right-hand side, the waves continue to vibrate, right? Now what's going to happen is we'll drop a whole bunch of rocks into this pond, right? You can see the fluctuations in the peaks of the water density. This you can then map out into colors where you have regions where there are local minima in the waves are blue, local maxima are red, and you can plot that then as a topographic map. Okay. What I'm showing here now is a topographic map of the temperature of the universe when you look out at wavelengths that are much longer than this microwave wavelengths. This is what's called the cosmic microwave background. The red spots are places that the temperature is higher than average, blue is lower than average, and what you can see is that there are these fluctuations. The universe is not completely uniform in temperature. If what you then do...
What's the big thing in the middle?
Yeah, what's the big thing in the middle? This is actually our galaxy. So our galaxy has a lot of emission too. So you can pull the galaxy out. You can learn a lot from the galaxy. You'll learn a lot about it. Yeah. So what you can do is you can take, you can take the distribution of peaks in this map, so the red spots, and ask, if I'm at a red spot, what is the probability that I'll get to another red spot within a given distance? So this is called a correlation function. So I'm looking at how correlated two points on the sky are, right? So in other words, this is over here is a plot of the relative sizes of these overdensities and their distances from one another. Okay, so this is an observation. This is just a way to take this 2D map and turn it into a 1D spectrum. This is what we observe in the universe. Down here is a model of the universe that contains normal matter at about 5%, dark matter at about 27%, and dark energy at about 67%. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to dial these knobs down, and you'll see how this spectrum changes. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to get rid of the dark matter. All the matter is made up of normal matter. Then I get rid of the dark energy. So I go, no dark matter, then no dark energy, and what I hope you can see is that this, when you do that, looks very different than the distribution that we see here. And this is one of the strongest pieces of evidence that we have for the existence of dark matter. These primordial fluctuations cannot be explained by any current model that we have of modifications of gravity. And so while modifications of gravity can do a good job at explaining why rotation curves of galaxies don't look the way we would expect from Newtonian physics, they cannot explain this. And the reason I'm emphasizing this point is that this program has really been emphasizing that point. We had a lot of discussion during the conference about this, and I mean, cosmology is really a strong indicator of this. Okay, so from that, this is basically our understanding of the constituents of the universe today. So it's roughly 70% dark energy. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm sorry, it's a dark matter program. We really don't know a whole lot about this component. What I can say, if you are interested in what the difference between dark energy and dark matter is, you can think of dark matter as an extra gravitational force that's pulling things together. You can think of dark energy as a repulsive force that's driving the universe apparent. Roughly 25% of the universe is made up of this dark matter. So, questions? Yeah?
I'm really a skeptic of this dark matter dark energy thing. There's some recent papers that really call into question and wonder whether or not we just don't understand gravity well enough. And can you comment on that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So I think when you talk about the dark energy piece of the pie, people talk about modifications to gravity that could potentially explain this. That I'm completely in line with. There are potential large-scale modifications to general relativity that could help explain dark energy. These are different than the small-scale modified Newtonian dynamics theories that are used to explain dark matter. Those theories have a really hard time predicting the cosmological observables. And so the explosion of information that's come from the CMB is probably one of the strongest pieces of supporting evidence for the dark matter as we understand it regime.
Got that.
So
my father is a retired chemist, and he's either a crackpot or a genius at this point. And so his pet theory is that, you know, all these things are wrong, and that there are there is matter that has negative mass.
Okay.
And so now my question is that something that's been considered at all, and what would that imply? Would it explain any of this?
Yeah. So in the context of dark matter, if I understand the negative mass idea, it would actually work contrary to what we need for dark matter needs more mass.
Okay, so
but for the dark energy side of things, what is usually thought of, dark energy is usually thought of as a negative energy density, which is not so dissimilar from what you could think of as a negative mass, because energy and mass are related. But more what this is thought of is like a vacuum pressure that's sort of space-time is pushing itself apart. And so that's sort of the conventional. But we don't really have we have an equation that can describe the way the universe appears observationally, but we don't have like a fundamental deep understanding of why that works that way. Yeah.
Would the discovery of a graviton help? Is any of that being considered in these theories?
So the graviton is essentially the analogy of a photon for light. So it is a particle constituent of a gravitational wave. It's generally believed that gravitons do exist. It's not believed that they have mass, because gravity is a long-range force. And in order to mediate a long-range force, your particle needs to be massless. And so generally the idea of a graviton won't solve these problems, but there is something called a gravitino, a symmetric partner to a graviton, which is a real headache for theoretical physicists and experimental particle physicists, because it essentially would not interact with standard model particles in a way that could be detected. And so its gravitational interaction would be all that you would have to be able to prove it. For posterity, I'm making a lot of blanket statements here that all have many caveats.
Let's go find dwarf galaxies.
Okay, let's go find dwarf galaxies. Okay, so if we take this dark matter model of the universe, dark matter plus dark energy plus baryons, and we seed the initial conditions of a numerical simulation, what we'll see and run, so basically we're taking the universe in its very flat, hot state, and then we are running time forward and seeing how dark matter clumps. And so the light regions in the simulation correspond to regions of high dark matter density. What you see is the dark matter clusters together what you see actually forming here is a large galaxy. Surrounding it are many smaller clumps of dark matter. At the end of the day, what you see is that a galaxy halo, as predicted from this dark matter plus dark energy plus normal matter paradigm, should have the visible part of the galaxy in the center, dark matter stretching out somewhat smoothly to much larger distances. That's what makes the rotation curves continue to be constant and go up. But in addition, many smaller clumps where you have overdensities of dark matter. This would be around all galaxies.
Okay.
Yeah?
Sorry.
Yeah.
One of the articles I read talked about the fact that some galaxies have much more apparent dark matter than our galaxy does.
Yes.
Have you been able to...
That's exactly the point. This is exactly what the talk is about.
I should get something.
Great. Yeah. So this is what our Milky Way looks like in visible. But if we could see in dark matter, this is the prediction that the dark matter hypothesis makes as to what we would see around the Milky Way. We would see our galaxy in the very center, but we would see all of this substructure, what are called dark matter halos and subhalos. They're really clumps. They're not like rings, right?
All that bright is dark matter?
Yeah, sorry. The bright in this plot is the dark matter. Yeah, so it's dark matter density has been made bright.
You didn't put any quotes, though, so you should say, quote dark matter.
What's the distance scale we're looking at?
Right, so the galaxy here, I have a good plot of this later on, but the galaxy here is about 100,000 light years across. One light year, we can do some math on the board, but one light year is 10 to the 16 meters. Okay, so it is 10 trillion kilometers. So this is 100,000 tenths of 1 million trillion kilometers.
So, the visible part of the Milky Way, could you just put your hands around it here for us?
We're just the center.
Stuff that we see.
That's the kind of the 16th.
Yeah. So this, right. Yeah. This is everything that we see is 100,000 light years.
Okay.
Yeah. This is about 10 times, 20 times that.
Yeah. And dark matter circling as well?
We don't believe that it rotates. At least it doesn't have a lot of net rotation to it. It does have some net angular momentum, but it hasn't. We don't believe it's collapsed down into a disk.
Let's see if it's net.
So this is simulation. Simulation predicts this. That's right. There is there are observational tests that we are performing to search for inhomogeneities in this dark matter structure, but yeah.
I also recall reading that there are galaxies they found that they cannot detect dark matter.
That is a great point,
either because of the way they're looking at it or the age of the galaxy.
Yeah. So there was one. There was a paper very recently in Nature. A hint to everyone. I'm on camera now. But Nature tends to publish things that are
provocative.
I didn't know. I'm sorry.
No. This is there is a galaxy that was claimed to have no dark matter in it. There are a number of issues that people have had with that analysis and the conclusions that were drawn from it. One thing is that there is scatter. So the amount of dark matter in your halo allows you to have a scatter in how much luminous matter you have in there. So the mapping between what you see and the dark matter halo is not perfectly one-to-one. There's like scatter around that. But that specific analysis has we can talk about some technical details on that, but not everyone agrees with that conclusion.
Yeah. So dark matter can have a linear velocity?
You
say it doesn't rotate.
Right. So what's a linear meaning translational?
Yeah.
So the idea is that there are particles of dark matter that are on orbits that take them through this halo. And those orbits are not coherent in the way that the disk of the Milky Way is, but rather they're randomized And they're all, it's like a gas, a ball of gas that's gravitational.
Certain clumps are larger than other clumps.
Certain, some of the clumps are larger than other clumps.
You see other matter being dragged along with it.
Great. Yes. Yes. The standard model of cosmology predicts that there should be many small galaxies around our Milky Way. Okay. That these small clumps of dark matter should host galaxies of their own. And it's been a topic of debate, including at this program, how many many is, right? What the quantitative definition of many is. But what we can do is we can go out and we can look for them, right? We can look for the galaxies that should live in these clumps of dark matter. So this is a picture from the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. This is our Milky Way galaxy stretching across the sky. And these are the two largest satellite galaxies of our Milky Way. So the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud. For a sense of scale here, this is the Milky Way. And these are the two Large Magellanic Cloud and Small Magellanic Cloud roughly to scale. As I said before, this is about 100,000 light years in diameter. And so the idea that we now have is that the Large Magellanic Cloud would sit in the largest of these dark matter substructures. And the question we want to ask is, can we find anything sitting in these small dark matter substructures? And so this is something, this is a search that's been going on for almost 100 years now. So this is the first of the small satellite galaxies of the Milky Way that was found after the Large and Small Magellanic Cloud. So it was found by Harlow Shapley in 1938. I think that he needed to draw each of these points. These are each supposed to be a star in the galaxy. Drew it by hand, looking through his telescope. No, this was actually in the Southern Hemisphere. I think it was a Harvard observatory, maybe in Africa, South Africa, maybe? Yeah. This is what the galaxy looks like with a more modern image. Hopefully the projector is good enough to see this. All right, so it's an overdensity of stars. It's roughly spherical. Through measuring the velocities of these stars, I can talk about this, I'll talk about this more a little later, but by measuring the velocities of these stars, you can tell how much mass needs to be binding them together, and you find that these, the galaxy like this needs to be made up mostly of dark matter. And so this is what our timeline for discovery of these small... A black hole would not do because, the distribution, yes. We actually don't know whether small galaxies like this have black holes in their centers.
It's insufficient to explain it.
Right. So these are discoveries that were made with photographic plates. So you see that it doesn't start at zero, so we knew about the Large and Small Magellanic Cloud even before we had telescopes. But you're coming along and finding objects like that sculptor dwarf galaxy. From looking at the stars in a dwarf galaxy like that in more detail, you can actually analyze the colors and the brightnesses, the magnitudes of those stars. So what I'm doing is shifting all the blue stars to the left, red stars to the right, and then shifting the bright stars to the top and the faint stars to the bottom. And you end up with something that people may have seen before in astronomy classes. This is a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, HR diagram. Looks something like this, right? And so what's happening is that you have all the, you have the red stars on the right side, blue stars, which are the hotter stars, on the left. You have brighter stars at the top and fainter stars at the bottom. Don't mind the fact that the numbers disagree with that. That's just astronomer convention. So this is a very characteristic plot for the evolution of a simple stellar system, and we can learn quite a bit from it. So from where this turnoff, this main sequence turnoff happens, this is where stars stop burning hydrogen and move off, right, onto, Lars can tell you everything about this, I'm sure he has, and it's on, right? So this is where stars move off the main sequence. This tells you something about the age of the stellar population. by where this entire plot is moved in magnitude, apparent brightness space, can tell you something about the distance. These stars have characteristic brightnesses, so if you move them farther away, they look fainter, but the shape of this distribution is the same. And by the slope here of the giant branch, you can tell things about the metallicity, so how many heavy elements are in these stones. What you find is that these dwarf galaxies are extremely old, 10 to 12 giga-years old, billion years old, nearly the age of the universe, that they're distributed around our Milky Way, the nearest one being about one Milky Way disk diameter away from us, all the way out to beyond the radius of the dark matter halo that we would expect. And you find that they're very metal poor, so they haven't had much evolution of heavy elements. So this can teach you a lot about the stars and the dwarf galaxies, but you can also use it as a way to try and find even fainter and fainter galaxies, because you now know what the colors and magnitudes of the stars in these dwarf galaxies should look like. So if you start with a dense stellar field, so these are stars in the Milky Way that are in front of the dwarf galaxy, if you then apply a cut, so this is a filter, think of it like a cookie cutter, that we're cutting on the colors and magnitudes of stars, brightnesses of stars. So I only take the stars that end up in my cookie cutter, and that cookie cutter came from the last slide. Then what I find is that there's actually an overdensity of stars here, and when I convolve with a filter, actually pops out as a significant excess here. Okay, but look at how many stars I'm counting here. This is tens of stars that I'm using to find this galaxy. So what do these galaxies actually look like? They look like this. And this is not the projector's fault. Right? You can't see anything here. So how about I circle the stars that belong to the dwarf galaxy? Okay, now maybe you see that there's a collection here. But how did I do that? Right? I can't just go circle random stars on a plot and tell you I've found a galaxy. So what I'm doing is that these circles correspond to stars that have the same velocities as each other. They have very nearly the same velocity through space. The other stars in this picture have velocities that are characteristic of the Milky Way disk. These are moving at much higher velocity. They're not part of our Milky Way. The way that I measure that velocity is through the Doppler shift, right? So what we do is we can look at the spectra of these stars. We see that these stars have distinct emission absorption lines. So there are regions where chemicals in the atmospheres of the stars absorb light. The positions of those lines can be measured in laboratory experiments. And so you can then calibrate based on how far redward or blueward those lines are shifted, what the velocities of the stars are. Okay? So in order to do this, we need some of the largest telescopes in the world. This is the Keck telescope in Hawaii. And the spectrum that comes out looks something like this, where you see these very sharp features associated with calcium triplet. And by calibrating them against laboratory spectra, we can tell how fast these stars are moving through space. It's of order 100 kilometers per second. So, Laura suggested that I might want to wake you up. So, just as an example of what the Doppler shift is doing, right, this is a siren. Let's see if I can do it. So here it's coming towards you. Now it's going away from you. Just by hearing that, you can tell exactly what's going on there. Right? It's the same idea with these spectral lines. So we're not looking at the wavelength of the sound, but we're looking at the wavelength of light. So here's an example from one of the newer dwarf galaxies that we found. So these are three different stars in the dwarf galaxy. You can see that these emission lines line up almost exactly with each other. There's even more information that you can get from this, though. So what you find is that yes, all of these stars are moving through space at more or less the same velocity, but they actually have a slight dispersion to that velocity. So they're not moving at exactly the same speed. They're in like a gas, where they have internal motions of the stars within the system. And by measuring how wide that dispersion is, you can get a measure of how much gravity has to be binding them there. So you can get a measure of the dark matter content, the total gravitating mass, by measuring the dispersions of the velocities of stars in these dwarf galaxies. So this is a really important figure, and I'll take a second to go through it. So what's being plotted here on the x-axis is the luminosity, the intrinsic brightness of galaxies and clusters of galaxies when you get to this side. And on the y-axis is the ratio between the total mass, so that's dark matter plus normal matter, over just the visible matter. So objects up here have 1,000 times more dark matter in them than normal matter. Objects down here have roughly the same amount of dark matter in normal matter. And so what you see is that these very faint objects sort of break into two classes. One are clusters of stars, which have essentially no dark matter in them, and at the same brightness, but much larger gravitating masses, you have the dwarf galaxies. And this has actually led to how we now conventionally define a galaxy. And so this is from a paper by Beth Willman and Jay Strader. It's a galaxy is a gravitationally bound collection of stars whose properties cannot be explained by a combination of baryons and Newton's laws of gravity. So it's essentially saying that there needs to be some extra gravitational binding force. In other words, that galaxies are living in dark matter halos.
So globular clusters don't fit in for that. Dark matter doesn't have to be a seat for globular clusters.
It's a great question, and it's an area of active simulation and investigation now. So the conventional picture is that no, that the globular clusters are not seeded by dark matter. People are looking in more and more detail into how globular clusters form.
Because they're very old.
They are very old.
They're not metal rich.
Correct. They look very similar to dwarf galaxies, except they're more compact, and they're essentially devoid of dark matter. Yeah?
Is there consideration about galaxies where the helium, the hydrogen content has been depleted, and how the dark matter is affected by that?
Like age. Closer to the Big Bang, what's the distribution of dark matter in those objects?
Yeah, so the belief of how, I think, let me say something and then you tell me if this has answered your question or not. Okay, so there is a question of how did these galaxies get so much richer in dark matter than their companions at larger luminosity? So there are two things at play here. And it's essentially that even though these galaxies are very rich in dark matter, they're still very small, right? They're still low mass. And that means it's very easy to drive gas out of these galaxies. So there are two processes that basically push all of the normal matter out of these galaxies and leave you just with a handful of stars and the dark matter. And those processes are one is called reionization. So this is in the early universe when the first stars and galaxies turned on. You got a bath of ionizing photons that basically washed a lot of the gas out of these galaxies before it could form more stars. And the other is supernova feedback. And so the first generation of stars that you formed, when you had supernova, they actually drove out the gas in these dwarf galaxies. And so that's our understanding of why these are so old and metal poor stellar populations, because they were only able to form early on.
So I'm trying to make sense of this diagram here. Yeah. You said that about 27% of the universe is made up of dark matter. And I'm looking at this and I can't really get my head around that. Tell me where that 20% is based on the chart that you
have. Yeah, that's a great question. So over here is where galaxy formation is the most efficient. So these are sort of Milky Way mass galaxies. where you have about the right ratio of dark matter to normal matter. Over here, this is just the visible luminosity in clusters, and as I said before, most of the baryonic mass in clusters is actually in the hot X-ray emitting gas, and that's not counted in this visible matter. For the dwarf galaxies, you've essentially ejected most of the baryonic matter, and so so here you've artificially enhanced the dark matter fraction, but these are still a small fraction of the total content.
So out of the dwarf galaxies, getting back to that, what percent of that 27% do you think you're looking at?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer offhand. Oh. As to, I mean, it is, I mean, most of the mass is in clusters.
Of course.
Do you expect the density different in dark dwarf galaxies or same?
Between different dwarf galaxies or between dwarf galaxies and normal galaxies? Yeah, so this is a great question.
Can you repeat the question?
So, yeah, sorry. The question is, do we expect the density of matter to be different,
dark matter,
to be different in the dwarf galaxies versus the standard Milky Way size galaxies? The answer is yes. But the answer is also, this is a huge topic of discussion right now within this program, exactly how your dark matter density profile, so the density of dark matter as a function of radius, changes with galaxy mass. And so once you throw the baryons, the normal matter, into the middle of this dark matter halo, it can do things to change the distribution of dark matter. And one of the reasons that we're really interested in the dwarf galaxies is they're in some ways in this Goldilocks zone where you have just enough visible matter to be able to trace where the dark matter is, but not so much that it alters the density profile, the density of the dark matter. And so the answer is yes. Generally, the conventional model of cold collisionless dark matter would have peaks. The dark matter would be very peaked towards the center of the dwarf galaxies. That can be altered with physics from stars and dust and gas. Yeah.
On that cluster to the right, the galaxies, where is our Milky Way?
Yeah, so it's around here, 10 to the 10.
And so the ratio is total mass to real mass is?
It's about 6.
6 to 1.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's much known about the distribution of black holes and their density and plot breakers.
Great question. Another topic that has been discussed a lot at the program is so what the cosmic microwave background tells us is that we can't produce all of the dark matter out of black holes that was once normal matter, right? So the usual way you think of a black hole forming is that you form a star, basically it goes supernova and implodes, you're left with a compact remnant, right? But the CMB counts all the baryons before they've had time to do that. So if you want to make up dark matter with black holes, you have to do it through primordial black holes that are formed through what's called the inflationary phase of the universe, through perturbations in the density field, extreme perturbations. There are constraints on what fraction of dark matter can reside in those black holes if they come in a certain range of masses. We haven't covered the entire range yet. There are some parts where we can't say definitively that it's not in black holes, but we've covered an appreciable amount yet so far, and it's constrained to be at the level of 10 to 20% could be in black holes. So it's a good question, and I would say that it is not the preferred explanation to dark matter right now, but it is viable in some range of parameter space.
There was an Israeli scientist who said that gravity got fired and it didn't go 1 over r squared forever.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, so is this, I'm not sure of exactly.
Ask about Bond.
Yeah, I think this is the modified Newtonian dynamics idea. And that has a really hard time explaining the cosmological measurements.
I'm still back to hydrogen. I don't think there's an infinite amount of hydrogen in the universe. So as the hydrogen is used up in stars and stars disappear because they got too old, you know, is black, you know, dark matter filling those gaps? Is it growing, or is there just an infinite amount of dark matter as well? Has anybody ever considered that?
Well, so we generally don't expect to be replenishing standard model particles, like creating protons out of dark matter at a rate that is appreciable. We have limits from not having seen that in the laboratory and not having been able to see this in indirect detection experiments. So it's unlikely that that is replenishing hydrogen in some way.
Well, are some of the small galaxies, large galaxies that have been reduced in size because they burned up the hydrogen in the galaxies?
Oh, this is an so generally what you see is the evolution in the stellar populations, right? And you do see that. You do see that in big old galaxies are called red and dead. So you essentially burned all the bright stars that burned off. You're left with the old faint stars.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so this is where we were in 2010. I was writing my thesis on something completely different around then, and I was still doing dwarf galaxy work, but I was doing it from the gamma ray side. I was a dark matter sort of particle astrophysicist at the time, and so I looked at, I came across a paper that had a map like this on it while I was writing my thesis, and so what it's showing here in gray is the area of the sky that we covered looking for these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies with what was called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. All the white region had been essentially untouched, right? And so this seemed like a huge opportunity region here. So if you think about this like an explorer, right? We're trying to investigate, you know, our local region of the universe. Then here's a map of the Earth with a similar region masked out of it. But in fact, we don't know if we're living in a world like that or a world like this, or a world where it's upside down. So it may be that all of Asia is unexplored, right, at the time that the Sloan Digital Sky Survey ended. And so for me, this seemed like, okay, here are the dragons. Let's go work on that. So I moved from Stanford to Fermilab and sort of immediately got shipped off to Chile. So this is the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. This is the Blanco telescope. It's a 4-meter telescope. Oops, sorry.
What's the elevation of that telescope?
It's about 7,200 feet, so it's not super high. Yeah, it's in the foothills of the Andes. This is our camera. We just built this brand new camera at Fermilab that got mounted on a 40-year-old telescope. Basically revolutionized the impact of this telescope. It went from being, maybe the 12th largest telescope in that part of Chile, to having the best wide field survey instrument on it.
Why is it special?
Why is it special? Okay, so it's special because it's big. So this is the focal plane of the camera. So it's about this big in diameter. It's 570 megapixels. It's made out of CCDs that are very deep, so very thick, which means that it's very sensitive to infrared light. And it's got great stability, great fast readout, basically is a sky surveying machine. And so this is just for a sense of scale on the telescope and the camera. And this is what the images that come down from this camera look like. So we've got 62 CCDs here. These are light detecting devices. In contrast, that's sort of the CCD, well, it's a CMOS detector, thinking your iPhone camera, right, for scale. This is the size of the full moon on this image. This is actually the Small Magellanic Cloud that we're looking at here. And the way we get the color information is by taking an image of the sky with one filter, then another filter, then another filter. This allows us to find dwarf galaxies that look like this. Okay, again, you're not going to see anything here. But with our algorithms, we're actually able, based on the expected color and spatial distribution of these stars, to identify which of them we expect to be members of the dwarf galaxies. We can then go out to some of the biggest telescopes in the world and measure what the velocities of these stars are, and we see that they are gravitationally bound and moving through space. So when we were starting out on this, there was a prediction from those simulations that we saw before about what the number of galaxies we should see with the dark energy survey would be. These are the galaxies that we saw. So you'll notice there are two colors of circles here now. So the filled circles are ones that we've been able to go to other telescopes and collect the spectra for. The open circles are objects that look very much like dwarf galaxies, but we haven't been able to collect spectra for yet. So we think that they're going to be dwarf galaxies. They look very much like.
What's DES?
So DES is the Dark Energy Survey. This is the new survey that I've been working on.
It's a ground-based survey.
It's a ground-based survey. And SDSS is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. It was the precursor to that.
What's the glitch in the graph there where it comes up and then goes horizontal?
Here?
Yeah.
This is after the Sloan Digital Sky Survey stopped surveying more area and before the dark energy camera was installed. So it's an artifact of the fact that it takes us time to build the instruments.
Intermission.
Everyone went and did something else. And so there's still a lot of sky. So in red here is now the region that we were able to survey with this survey, with the dark energy survey. But there's still a lot of sky out there that we haven't gotten to yet. And the next instrument is coming. Okay, so this is the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. We're not waiting. We're hoping that we don't have another glitch here. So we're using the dark energy camera as much as we can to survey as much of that open region of sky as possible. Happy to talk about that offline. But our hope and expectation is that by the time the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope comes online, we will be able to see several hundred, about 250 satellite galaxies of the Milky Way.
Where is that going to be?
This is going to be on.
It is.
Yeah, it is. That is the picture of it. Yeah.
Oh.
Oh. Okay. So it is right here.
Still in Chile?
Still in Chile. Okay. So I think we're at a good time to stop.
Go back a couple of slides to your sea monster one. So this one, that one, yeah. So can you explain why those areas are white that they haven't been surveyed?
Yeah, great question. Okay, so the dark energy survey is actually mostly interested in dark energy. So to start out answering that question, I'll say why we surveyed the area that we did. So this is a map of the sky in galactic coordinates. So imagine that we're sitting in our galaxy and we look out from inside the galaxy, and what actually stretches across the middle here is the plane of our galaxy. So this is a very difficult region to survey for extragalactic astronomy. So that's very challenging. The other parts, the Sloan footprint up here was dictated by the fact that it was in the northern hemisphere and just couldn't get down that far to see that part of the sky. And so we're essentially using the dark energy camera to try and fill in all the regions sort of around here. And with LSST, we should be able to cover most. It's also in the southern hemisphere, so you can only see the southern part of the sky. But we hope to cover this in much greater sensitivity.
Okay. I'm curious about the structure of the dark matter.
Yeah.
Because in a long slide ago, you showed a halo, you know, and it had its little modules of clusterness, but pretty much it was sort of scattered all over in a big sphere, it seemed. And yet it's old and it has impact on baryonic matter for its structure, it seems, or it relates. So why doesn't it over time create more of a structure if it, you know, why don't we see something that's more of a pattern in its structure?
Right, and so like a disk, for example. Yeah, so there are models of dark matter where essentially, in order to create a disk, you need to radiate energy in some way. And the dark matter particles, in our simplest case, are non-interacting. They don't collide, they don't transfer energy with each other. They don't radiate energy. If you make that dark matter picture more, some would say complex, some would say beautiful, some would say fully functional, right? You can have mechanisms where the dark matter is able to radiate energy in a similar way to the normal matter, which would allow it to collapse into disk-like formations. Maybe that was getting at it?
That's interesting. So, like, why is that? But
So I think that's a good talk for a particle theorist.
Please. Well, I'm always a little troubled by the angular momentum of our galaxies, and I'm wondering, you showed us the galaxy, you know, the Milky Way has obviously got a lot of angular momentum. It's probably got that by collision of galaxies or whatever, but the dark matter background that they were living in didn't show any of that. And I guess it's sort of the same question. I mean. Right. Are we saying that the dark clumps of dark matter can't form spirals because they don't interact with one another? There's no dissipation to...
That's right. So there is some net angular momentum, but it's spread out over such a wide radius that, you know, it's like an ice skater spinning, right? Once you bring your arms in, then you start spinning much faster. But there's no way for the dark matter to bring its arms in, right? There's no way for it to dissipate the energy so that it collapses into a disk-like structure. And that's the idea. So there is some net angular momentum, but it's not enough to collapse down. There's no mechanism for the dark matter.
I mean, the angular momentum in the galaxies don't need to have interaction, right? I mean, you can get two galaxies going by one another, mm-hmm. They'll start to cycle around one another. The galactic dark matter should do the same thing, right?
And the smaller clumps that you see are on orbits, right? They're on orbits around the central halo. But the ability to collapse into a disk is different than the merging of objects. And so these are
dissipation sets of interaction.
Okay, so speaking of dissipation, so let's thank Alex one more time.